Accession number 28625, Reel 7.
Good morning, Mr. Strachan.
Morning, Ernie.
The last time we were speaking, we were still speaking about Borneo, which I believe would have been in 1965.
That's correct.
Okay, I have a few questions still to ask you about that. One of them was about the communications while you were still in... is it Kalabakin?
Kalabakin, yes.
Did you have communications with the other areas, the other locations?
Yes, each location has got a main radio which is coordinated to communicate with all the other fellow companies' locations and your main headquarters as well. And each day you'd be in communication with the headquarters saying what you'd done or what you wanted advice on or to receive in terms of stores and ammunition and things like that. Each call sign identified the location. So one was A Company, two was B, three was C, and so on. And you then had your smaller radios which you used to communicate with when you were out in the jungle, which could be carried, but the other ones were big and much more powerful.
Was there ever any problems with the radio signal or anything?
Sometimes these things do go wrong, but there are ways of getting them repaired or carrying substitutes, etc. Generally speaking, they're very reliable, and provided you have a very good aerial, as it were, and the weather was in your favour, yes, you seldom any problem.
Okay. And we spoke the last time as well about the other locations, although you didn't see the men in the other locations, you knew they were there. Did you have radio contact with them as well?
Yes, yes.
And what about the supplies? You also spoke there about the supplies that came in. Did you ever have any problems getting supplies in?
We were dependent upon the RAF in finding us. We were in this valley quite near the border, and we had a grass runway which was 1,200 feet long, surrounded by hills. And every Wednesday we would get what was called an airdrop from this Beverly aircraft coming on. And I would raise it from the ground and saying that they would be asking, where on earth are you? And have you got such and such, meaning wind speed and all these sort of things, to which my answer was always negative. But I could say, well, I see you, I've got you visual, and you're turn left, turn port, turn starboard, or whatever, and keep coming, and we would set up a smoke grenade, which eventually they would identify, and then they would circle around and come in and drop the goods by parachute. There's no other way that we could get stores other than helicopters. But it was a weekly supply which included anything that you needed, it had asked for, including, most importantly, the NAPI supply, which was the B and the lemonade for the jock. And you were entitled to 10 cans of liquid per person per week. Not necessarily beer, and each man was rationed to 2 cans, and we used to keep. We didn't have any money. We didn't need money, but we had a book in which everybody's name was recorded, and whatever purchases you'd made from the canteen, every month it would go back to the pay office and would be deducted from your account. So with the soldiers going out in patrol, that meant that they weren't using their 2 cans of beer. So, generally speaking, everybody had 2 cans of liquid per day, and that was it.
And you mentioned the canteen there. What type of building was this canteen?
Just a shed, just a corrugated shed, secure, obviously, and various people would be given a period of respite by looking after it for a month, etc. But it sold soap, toothpaste, and shaving cream, and such like things as that. And Meerschaum pipe seemed to be the vogue then. I think everybody tried to smoke a pipe. And you could also get dropped the Seiko watches, which were very good timepieces and at a reasonable price too. That was specifically asked for to individuals. That was a simple but effective system.
Okay. And was the Seiko watch, was that quite a fashionable watch for its
time? Oh, yes, yes.
Okay. And so whilst you were out there, was it seen as maybe, although there was always an element of danger, would it have been seen as quite a good posting because you could save up a bit of money or something?
You could certainly save money, but it's perhaps not the right way to do it. But yes, the people could go for 4 days leave to Singapore or someplace during the tour. And those of you, including myself, who didn't want to do that, I mean, as a married man, I had no wish to do that, and I was happy to move around the location, seeing my friends, as it were, sort of hitchhiking a lift in a boat or a plane or a helicopter or something.
And could you do that quite easily? You know, like.
Well, you could. There was always some sort of movement of some sort.
Okay. And you also mentioned this runway. Were planes actually able to land on this runway, or was it just a clearing?
Planes could land on it, but they were mainly sort of missionary planes, sort of 3-4-seater probably the biggest. And at the end, having arrived by helicopter, we were then picked up by a twin-engined one that was piloted by the Malayan Air Force. And they just got in and they just got out, shall I say. I mean, they dropped quickly, having crossed the ledge of the hill, and dropped quickly and stopped quickly. And it's the same when we left. I remember looking and thinking that we are never going to clear it. So it was used principally by helicopters for us and missionary services for the locals who lived in the villages not too far away from us.
And could you walk to these villages? Was that
well, you didn't know. You'd no means of leaving your perimeter unless you were on a patrol. There was no relaxation in that sense.
Okay then. And was there, when you speak about the hill as well, was this like a mountain or was it just hills?
Just a hill, we would call. Yes.
Okay then. And relaxation whilst you were at the camp as well, was there any relaxation like reading or films or things?
You could read. Everything obviously was out of date in terms of a newspaper, if we ever got that. And there were certainly books, and they were kept in a library where the canteen was. Very, very occasionally you got a film, and that was a great event that it did occur. But generally speaking, we just occupied ourselves there. For instance, improving the camp was one of my themes, to improve the digging of your toilets, for example, to make them much more pleasant and free from flies, to your huts, to your flooring of the huts that we were in. We had just corrugated top, thin in the top, and we then had to get the trees from the jungle and the floorboards from the airdrop, the pallets in which the stores came on, and we could utilise that to make a floor of a hut. And we just, we carried out the sequence throughout the camp. So we were always getting cement, for example, to floor the dining room, the dining hut as such. There was always something to be done. Built our own little football pitch, and I remember we called it Hamden Mini Minor. Yes, there was always some innovation that We played lots of sport. We played volleyball, badminton, and football. We had a Heath Robinson system where we drew the water from the bun at the bottom of the perimeter up into a little hill within the camp, and we were able to heat it and produce hot shower at a certain time during the day only. So yes, you're utilising this improvisation, I suppose, in a sense, like what they did as prisoners of war. You're never idle. You were thinking, how can I improve or better this system?
Yeah, I must admit, when you've been telling me all this, I didn't expect like a football pitch or anything.
Yeah,
like
but
that.
The football pitch was very curvaceous. It's really hilly. But, you know, it was a means by which you had an area and you two goalposts, which we had made and painted a sign, Hamden Mini Minor. But, I mean, certainly not level playfields at all.
And how did you keep up the training, like a rifle training or anything like that?
We could fire in certain areas. There was certainly a restriction of fire, perhaps just a quarter of your perimeter. So you had a 75% arc from which you could fire, which we did do, testing them.
Okay. And you spoke about your perimeter there as well. Was there a fence or anything, or was it, you know?
Yeah, barbed wire.
So it was actually a proper camp?
Yes, yes.
Uh-huh.
Well, not a proper camp, but an improvised but secure on two hills, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And these improvements that you were doing to the camp as well, were these things that the army encouraged, or was this just ways that you and other men that were there thought of improving them?
We thought about it, and there's no planning permission required out where we were. You just made sure that you improved your little lot that would assist you and benefit the men and give them an interest as well.
Okay, and how many men would have been, or approximately how many men would have been in the camp?
120 maximum.
Okay, and in the evening when it got dark, were you allowed to put on lights at the camp?
Yes, yes, within the camp we had, we eventually got a small generator that took a low wattage bulb throughout. So when it got dark, you could get light, and then at 10:30 at night, the generator was switched off and everybody retired to bed.
Okay. And did you still mount a guard on this camp?
Yes, day and night.
And was there ever any threat?
There was a possibility, but nothing occurred. But it would be extremely foolish not to be ready. For instance, you had a series of slip trenches around your whole perimeter, which I had numbered, and then each day you would make sure they were reallocated, as and when a platoon went out. And you had to make sure that their trenches had been filled by some other elements. And you had illuminations which could be set off through an electric battery, but you were secure.
And when a platoon did go out, what was the general length of time that they went out for?
Well, it fluctuated. Anything up to a week was an average. 3, 4, 7 days. And you would do, depending on where you're going and what you're doing, you could do a 14-day patrol quite easily. But the only problem is, we once did that, but you had to carry everything with you, whatever food you wanted, you were given, and it was entirely up to you if you wanted to carry every little morsel of sugar, salt and tea. And the idle guys were a sort of discard that they thought they'd never need. But the older soldier was much more wiser. And by, say, the 12th or 13th day, he was eaten when the other guy maybe wasn't.
And when you say that as well, was there ever any occasions when you could get food, like, from the jungle, you know, fruit or anything?
if you're aware of what the yes, you could get a you could drink water from the vines, the trees, or you could eat the sort of sweet potato root that you get in some plants. But only in emergencies, I think, would you resort to that sort of thing.
Yeah, the camp itself wouldn't actively get any fruit from there.
No. Anything that we ate in the main camp was dropped by parachute on a Wednesday. So that meant that you obviously you're only getting limited fruit and vegetable, and the rest was canned and packed meals and stuff.
So would it be fair to say that the food you were eating in camp was basically the same that you would have got in any British Army camp?
Not really, in that, for example, we didn't have freezers or fridges or anything like that. So you had to be careful what you got that wouldn't be put off by the heat. So yes, you had lots of bully beef and things like that.
Okay. And how long were you actually there for in this particular camp?
Just over 4 months. Mm.
And was that how long that particular tour of duty was?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, we arrived there in February 65. And we went back to Edinburgh in February 1966. So, Longbanger, the camp that we've just been discussing, that was the last camp that we'd been in.
Oh, okay, so it was Longbanger. I thought we were still speaking about Calabachan.
No, Calabachan was the first tour.
Okay.
And after that, 4 months, 4.5 months, we went back to Kota Balud for a rest and retraining. And then from Kota Balud, we went by helicopter direct to Longbanger. And then from Longbanger, we went back to back to the little island. I'm sorry, I forgot the name of it at the moment. And it was from there that we then flew back to Singapore.
So did you always know, when you first went out, did you know it was going to be a year's...
Yes.
Tour of duty. And that first camp, that Calabachan, was that still the same type of idea as Longbanger, is it?
No, Longbanger was a very primitive camp.
Okay.
Calabachan had been properly... erected huts, that by that lovely Welshman who looked after and managed the wood industry up there.
Right, okay, I'm with you. And the place in between, you know how you said you were at Calabachan and then you were...
Back at Kota Balud.
Uh-huh.
Kota Balud is where we first went to on arrival in the country, and there we stayed to become acclimatised and trained and fit to move to the first operational base, which was Calabachan, and then a rest from there back to Kota Balud. And then from Kota Balud we went to I'm just thinking, from Calabachan we went back to Kota Balud via an aircraft carrier. And then from Calabachan we went, after rest and recuperation, retraining, we went back to, we went to Longbanger for the second half of our tour, and that was by helicopter.
And then once you came back from there, that was your tour of duty finished, was
yes,
it?
Yes.
Okay. And so did you not take any leave when you were away, or, you know, when we spoke about that you could take leave and go down to Singapore?
I didn't want to. Mm-hmm.
And so did you save up your leave for when you went home or something?
No, you could. You didn't accumulate that sort of thing. The 4 days leave was a sort of rest and recuperation that you could get, but not accumulative.
Okay. So when you were coming back to the UK after this tour of duty in February 66, was there another regiment going to replace you or something?
We were relieved by Gurkhas. We took over from Gurkha and relieved by them.
Okay. And how did you feel about coming back to Britain?
Fine. Happy.
And how did you get back there?
Well, we were the first regiment to do a complete year unaccompanied overseas on an operational tour. So our families were very much on their own, and the responsibility to the wives, to bring up the children, look after them. And I think that in itself was a tremendous strain for them.
And were you able to get mail back to your wife and things?
Oh yes, yes, the regular air mails.
Any phone calls or anything?
No. With no phones. No. I mean, we have advanced tremendously since then, but no.
It must have been quite a difficult period, really, in that respect, with families.
Yes, it was. And I remember when we eventually arrived in Edinburgh, thinking my wife was so slim, and this is obviously attributable to, I had three children, and she had utilised her energies in looking after them, as did the other wife. So yes, it was quite a strain from them.
And the children must have grown as well, did they?
Oh yes, no doubt about that.
And how did you get back? Was it, were you flown
back? We flew back from that island that I couldn't remember, was Labuan. And it was from Labuan that we moved to Singapore. And then we came home, I think British Airways or some firm that we'd tasked by the MOD to take us home. And we flew to Edinburgh, and I distinctly remember when it was a Sunday morning, and there was no Cussons and McSighs available on the Sunday morning, so the captain said, well, we'll have to go to Glasgow. Well, that wasn't very a popular statement to make. So, bless him, he circled more and kept trying and trying and trying, and then ultimately he said, Eureka, we are going to Edinburgh, where all our families were waiting to receive us. And the customs chaps were on the go then. And we arrived there, and I'll never forget that, despite the fact we'd been out of the country for a whole year and had only about 2 days to buy presents, and on each occasion I went there, we had always buy a doll for my two girls and something else for my son. And we were all horrified to find how much customs duty we had to pay and the little things that we came home with. And they were quite ruthless. I don't know why, but that sort of thing you can never forget. But the main thing was the pilot and his perseverance and his consideration in doing what he did do.
So you went back to Edinburgh. So did you go back to Redford Barracks? And
yes.
Just the same as before?
Absolutely, absolutely.
And you still had your house in Dreghorn?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I believe you said that you were doing public duties again whilst in Edinburgh?
Yes. Oh, that was looking after the guarding the castle, guarding your own camp, doing any sort of visitation, guard of honour. And then we had the Royal Guard, which was in August of 1966.
And whereabout was that?
That the Queen goes to Balmoral, and the camp that we we utilised, was it Balata, a Victoria barracks in Balata, a quaint barracks.
Okay. Was this the same barracks that you had used some time before when you were up in Balata?
Yes, when I first did it, yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Same one. Mm-hmm. I was a sergeant there, and this time I was very proud to be the guard sergeant major.
So what were your duties as the guard sergeant major?
Training the men for public duties, training the men for duties on the hill, which we were there primarily for, as beaters, and just helping out in the royal household, going to the church every week with the Queen and her household, meeting them initially in a very formal parade outside Balmoral Castle entrance, and then on the conclusion of the guard, we said farewell to her ceremonially in front of Balmoral Castle. But in between that time, as I said, we would have either every Sunday we would have a detachment that would form up in the avenues of the castle and march to Craffy Kirk, which is quite a spectacle, lots of people watching. And on occasion we have a full pipe band or a military band, which we had. And I distinctly remember one very popular Sunday when our military band had played the Yellow Submarine tune, and it had appeared in the papers, and this military band playing something very modern but very effective to march to. And Princess Anne had turned up with a yellow hat on, and obviously one related one to the other.
Okay, and how many men would you have taken with you for this? You know, how many men would have been up in Ballater with you?
I think it was somewhere in the region of 104. That's all the bed spaces you had there.
And were they handpicked? Did you?
Yes. You have to have men of talent and integrity and good behaviour.
Okay. And I imagine when you were on these formal parades, like at Craffy Church or Balmoral or wherever, you would have been in your best kit.
Yes, we were. Mm-hmm.
Was that generally kilts? Or?
Yes, always kilts.
Mm-hmm. And so they were like all pressed well and
yes, proper. Absolutely. Okay.
And you spoke about the formal parade when you first met her, you know, at Balmoral each time. Mm-hmm. How close did you get, Claire, yourself?
As close as I am to you. She walked around and spoke to different people. And then you get closer still to her when you get invited to the Gillies Ball, which is held twice during your tour, and some 20 soldiers get invited to attend. And I had danced with her when I was a sergeant, and I was privileged again to dance with her when I was a sergeant major. And we danced the...
Sorry about that little problem. Which dance was it, Mr.?
We danced the Dash of White Sergeant.
Okay.
You were made aware that the Queen would like to dance with you, and the MC, who was the Queen's Pike Major, and he happened to be a gone-hander too, and he took both my colour sergeant and myself. We had to walk up the centre of the hall, the ballroom, and be introduced to Her Majesty and the Duke of Edinburgh, and we started the first Dashiell Light Sergeant, and off we went, and that was a great occasion.
When you were introduced to her like that, did you have to bow or anything?
Well, you lower your head and call her Your Majesty in the first answer, and thereafter, Ma'am.
And were you very nervous?
Oh, yes. Healthily so, but she was good, I have to admit. And later on, she paid a visit, her and her lady in waiting and a policeman, came down to visit us at the barracks, in Victoria Barracks in Ballater.